To walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict.
Tommy said, Mr. President, you're wrong. Now that takes a lot of guts.
I'm for peace and quiet, Mr. Lute. It's why I came to the UN. Quiet diiplomacy.
Yes, well, now it's time for our first foreign affair for the year, where we explore what's underway in the world in a way that maybe doesn't get the coverage it once did. And perhaps it'll encourage you to engage in lively water cooler conversations with your colleagues and friends, along with the politics, the domestic politics. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by three of our regulars to kick us off. Hervé Lemahieu, the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute, Emma Connors, the Financial Review's Southeast Asia correspondent, and Professor Michael Wesley, Deputy Vice-Chancellor International at the University of Melbourne. Welcome to you all.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thanks very much.
Happy New Year.
Indeed, Happy New Year. Now, I'd like to start with something that was largely overlooked by the general media coverage in Labor leader Anthony Albanese's press club speech last week, but it really hit me when I read through the speech because of the rather different tone it struck for Australia's attitude to our region. Let's have a listen.
A country that embraces its place in Asia, the fastest growing region of the world in human history, forging deeper relationships in the region as the tyranny of distance gives way to the privilege of proximity.
The privilege of proximity. Now, I certainly hadn't heard that phrase before. I suppose it harks back to Paul Keating and the push for us to be more tied to Asia. Times clearly have changed for a range of reasons. Now, Michael Wesley, you did recently write that Australia needed to find a new Asia narrative. Is this the sort of thing you were thinking about?
Yeah, it's really interesting that you go back to Paul Keating's time of Asian engagement. In that piece, Geraldine, I argued that actually the situation has shifted quite considerably. Back in, Paul Keating's heyday, it was all upside for Australia to engage with Asia. You know, there was an economic rationale. There was also a security rationale. We were proposing new bits of regional architecture that would bring the region together. And it was all underpinned by what you might call a strong economic logic that binding ourselves to Asia would make us richer, but it would also reduce the causes of conflict and insecurity. Nowadays, we've got a completely different mindset. There's a sense in which, in the aftermath of coercive economic diplomacy on behalf of China, the COVID pandemic, in which we've seen all sorts of supply chain disruptions, there is a sense, I think, in which economic integration is no longer seen as a great fix-all and unmitigated positive for this country. And so I think the real foreign policy challenge for whomever wins the May election will be, what are the new terms of engagement with Asia? How do we maximise, our proximity while minimising the risks that might come from that?
You also talked very interestingly in this, I thought, excellent essay for AsiaLink, that in a way the Asian project had become a bit fragmented itself. I'm not just talking about China, I'm talking about the broader issue. And the narrative frayed, and there was sort of, as you say, what looms now is a series of dissonances of aspirations that lead to bad outcomes, disconnects between differing national interests and pressures to pull ourselves in all sorts of different directions. So that's why I thought the phrase proximity, privilege of proximity, was very interesting choice of language.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I think that one of the things we've seen is really the dissipation of Australian efforts. There was a sense back in the 90s, both Keating and Howard used this real convergence of our interests. So our economics and our security relationships all seem to be reinforcing each other and building off each other. These days, we have these quite disparate economic relationships where We're very complementary with China, but we're worried about becoming even more complementary with China. In fact, in all sorts of fields, we're intervening in the market in ways to reduce our dependence on China, which is a very different way to behave. And in our relationships with other countries, Indonesia, India, Vietnam, and others, we're starting to try and build economic relationships in, you know, from much lower bases, mm-hmm. but also, you know, trying to build in security relationships there as well.
Yeah, you do,
it's not always working.
No, you do make the point that our international relations are much more extensive than just foreign policy, which is or defence policy. Very interesting. Now, Hervé, do you think a Labor Party or any government can shift the narrative to make it more nuanced and not just about China, or do you think this is going to take years?
Yeah, look, I think it's interesting that despite the fact that foreign policy and national security is often seen as a bipartisan arena of Australian politics, there is, as Michael points out, I think a very heated debate around the narratives with which we approach our region. And both sides of politics are harking back to different historical eras. So we've heard there the privilege of proximity, very much harking back to Paul Keating and an era, a post-Cold War end of history high that we experienced in this region and much of the rest of the world around the promises of economic integration, inclusive security, great power politics receding.
Sort of friendship that, too, I thought.
Yes, absolutely. But it's not quite the reality we're confronted with today. And there does need to be an adjustment, I think, to that doctrine. On the other hand, the Liberal Party, in particular, Scott Morrison, Peter Dutton, love to go back to the 1930s as their preferred historical decade with which they compare today, which is to say it's primarily a threat-based prism of understanding dynamics within our region, a much more pessimistic view of deteriorating a geopolitical environment for Australia and the potential of war with China. And there comes that fixation as well on China. And I think in many ways, we're going to have to accept that Asia is larger than China and that as fixated as we are on China, we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. There are other opportunities. This is not just about war and peace. And I think the biggest challenge for Australia right now is how do we relate with other middle powers? How do we relate with neighbours like Indonesia, where there is increasing strategic divergence, where middle powers in Southeast Asia in particular are inclined to hedge as a way of managing their relations with the US and China, whereas we are increasingly going down the track of balancing quite proactively against China in military and strategic terms and associating ourselves with bigger powers, major powers like the United States, like Japan and India, who form that sort of outer ring within the Indo-Pacific, but are not necessarily viewed as insiders within Southeast Asia. So there, I think, lies the central tension. Neither party, I think, really addressing it head on. In fact, this speech by Albanese was not primarily a foreign policy speech. This was almost an afterthought given, it's 16 pages of speech, very interesting speech, but primarily
two
about domestic politics.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. So I don't think it's a fully fleshed out narrative yet, but it is interesting that I think the Labour Party is thinking about recrafting a narrative, but the challenge is very much ahead of them. I don't think they've really cornered it yet.
And of course, Emma Connors, it's this reactions or relationship with Southeast Asia that you think in particular we underdo.
Yes, certainly. I mean, you know, we are so close to this region and it is growing so quickly. You know, it's not just our security and trade, but incredible business opportunities up here if we can strengthen the links. But I'm with Hervé too. You know, if you look at how the Southeast Asian countries manage their relations with the US and China, you know, they in some ways they're in exactly the same position as we are, right? You know, that they do a lot of business with both and rely upon them both for security support in some ways. But they, as Hervé said, they hedge their bets, whereas we tend to come out, you know, sort of blundering, all sides firing, and, you know, just leave a sort of trail behind us. Well, there was an interesting speech given by, sorry, I just want to, I think this quote sort of demonstrates that former Singaporean Foreign Minister, Georgia was speaking just last month, and he was talking about how the Singaporeans, you know, are very careful in what they do diplomatically. And he said, when we deal with the Javanese, we are very polite and very subtle. When we deal with the Australians, we have to be forthright or we will not be understood. I think, you know, there's this definite feeling up here that Australians are not very good at diplomacy.
And, of course, the Japanese, as you've pointed out, Hervé, in your power index, the Japanese are really very, very skillful diplomats these days, possibly some of the best in the world. That's the general view, isn't it?
Well, they are, and I don't mean to say this in a negative way, but the Japanese are fork-tongued in some sense. They and actually that's a virtue, in the sense that who they speak with determines their messaging. And you have very good Japanese diplomats based here in Canberra, which are primarily the alliance managers, very close to the United States as well, who will say one thing to us, but their diplomats in Southeast Asia very much more on the sort of Singaporean aligned front, much more subtle. You have to read between the lines. And I think in some sense, there is something that could be learned. You know, there's something that we can learn from in Australia as well. We don't do subtleties all too well. But beyond that, I do think, you know, this is not a challenge unique to Australia. The strategic environment has changed. Asia is a lot more fractured. ASEAN grouping is showing much less promise. I mean, as a result of a combination of internal weaknesses, the Myanmar coup, which we're about to talk about, as well as the rise of great power politics and the formation of coalitions of the willing, which is essentially what the quadrilateral dialogue is about, with Japan and India, Australia and the US, undermining that kind of inclusive multilateral architecture of ASEAN. And so this is a challenge for all of us, not just Australia.
In election year, it's something else also you've got to choose. You know, the risks, of course, in an election year, it would appear, are quite considerable. So I do think that's going to be very interesting to watch as the election approaches. And look, interesting in this, in terms of how much we see things as threat and how much we see potential, the Port of Darwin discussion, which was leased by the Northern Territory government back in 2015 to a Chinese firm to run the port itself, and at the time the Defence Department found there were no national security grounds that worried them. And then there was a review last year, and very quietly at the end of the year, the Defence Department did a review and said they could see no national security grounds for ending the controversial 99-year lease. Now, you're one of the few, Hervé, that hasn't got much coverage at all, really, because it wasn't, I think, the predicted outcome. But you're one of the few who is not surprised by this.
I'm not sure if I'm one of the few, but I do think that it comes back to the same fundamental logic, which is that it's unless the Port of Darwin is being used for military purposes by the Chinese, which it doesn't seem to be the case, a commercial contract can always be nationalized in the event of an outbreak of war between ourselves and China. So there isn't much, I don't think, that constitutes a real existential threat for the sovereignty of Australia. This is different to, for example, the critical digital infrastructure such as 5G. I just don't think, I mean, I can see why this would cause a degree of alarm and public perception might be against it, but really it doesn't stack up as an argument. And I think that's what the studies have borne out. It is not a threat to Australia, and it would be very easy were our relations to become warlike with China for us to nationalize that facility, and there wouldn't be a problem.
And Michael Worsley, do you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think that the kind of scaremongering that's been going on about the land bridge lease of the Port of Darwin is a bit ridiculous, really. As Hervé says, it can be nationalised. But there's also the case that the Australian government at any time can unilaterally determine the purposes for which a port will be used. Now, in the case of a conflict breaking out between Australia and China or the United States and China, it is inconceivable that the Chinese would have any particular reason to use the Port of Darwin. I mean, it would place any Chinese vessels and supplies that were using the Port of Darwin within easy attacking distance if used at all. So I think it's an entirely rational judgment for the Defence Department to come to.
All right, let's turn to Myanmar. And Hervé, you care very definitely about this because you actually grew up and finished your schooling in Myanmar. It's a year since the military junta seized power, and the country is now in an increasingly bad state because of this. The world appears to have turned away. The Economist wrote a piece that everybody's forgetting about Myanmar. You believe Australia should have been actively using its regional influence in face-to-face contact much more to try to alleviate things.
Yeah, look, I think sadly a year on, the situation has really ossified. I think there was a very narrow window of opportunity in the immediate weeks and months that followed the coup to try to influence events there. And even then, the likelihood of really changing the calculus of the generals was always limited. But it was an opportunity lost, not just by Australia, but by the global community. I think we've moved on. We're no longer really in the business of democracy promotion. The veneer of glamour and inspiration that Aung San Suu Kyi inspired the world over as a sort of Nelson Mandela type figure for Asia had totally been exhausted by the time that the military moved against her. And so there's a lot less sympathy or sort of opposition figures in Myanmar that really cut through in the public imagination. So we sort of left it to stew. And of course, a year on, we're confronting a situation, an absolute, you know, humanitarian disaster, a lost decade of development and growth. The economy is 30% smaller than what it should have been. It will be about 40% smaller by the end of the decade, according to our analysis.
My goodness.
And this is a lost generation. Yeah. So I do think there was much more we could have done as Australia. And I think as a middle power, without any sort of direct partisan interests, we're not a neighboring country of Myanmar in the way that China or India or Thailand are, we could have tried to do more to bring together both our Western partners as well as some of the Asian partners and then back up ASEAN. I think ASEAN by itself is simply not strong enough.
Its
influence
trying.
In Myanmar is consistently overrated, though.
Emma, you've written about how some in the business community are leading the way, deciding to sideline the Myanmar military source of funding by exiting the country. Is that turning out to be quite effective, do you think?
Yeah, look, I think this is really a key point. Chris Sidoti, the former Australian Human Rights Commissioner, made the point that in some ways business is sort of leading the way in terms of actual taking action that hurts the Tatmadaw or the Myanmar military. And we've seen in recent weeks Total, Chevron and our own Woodside pull out. Total and Chevron are particularly interesting because they operate the Yadana gas field, which is essential. And it also provides huge amount of export dollars because half of the power produced goes to Thailand. So the question now is what happens? Thailand is not run by a particularly democratic government and they seem to have quite a bit of sympathy with the military. So they're likely to keep that operation going and take up the interests abandoned by Total and Chevron. But the point is that the money will still be coming in because it goes into the joint venture partner that's the SOE combined with the military. And this is $1 billion a year at least that goes straight to the military and they use it, you know, to buy weaponry that, you know, causes extreme. What's going on in the country is just so awful. It's
shocking.
Hard to.
It's the really, more you read about it, when you do turn your attention to it, I tell you, it's a huge shock. There's just the bloodletting underway.
Massacre of children. It's just really, really terrible. So, but one thing that we can do is attack the money, right? Go for the money. So if we can put sanctions on that state-owned enterprise that gets these export dollars, then you can hurt the military's purchasing power. Mm. And Australia, I'm pretty sure with the new sanctions law we have that went through in December.
Oh, the Magnitsky thing.
Indeed. We could do that. You know, we probably don't actually receive many of those dollars. I'm pretty sure we don't, but at least we could stand up. And this is something that activists and the alternate government are calling on the UN and the US and the EU to do. So it would be a real statement if we did do that.
Michael Wesley Hever himself has said it's almost like going to become like the Irish Troubles. You know, Myanmar, they can't prevail, the Tatmadaw, nor can the oppositions. You know, it's like a slow-burning, continuing issue that they've learned they can rule by the barrel out of the barrel of the gun, but not govern. So, I mean, this is a very, very it's a terrible thing for the region, isn't it?
Yeah, look, a couple of observations, Geraldine. The first one is that I think this is a pattern of conflict that the Myanmar military has never really faced before, this level of low-level warfare and really insurgency in their own heartland. Mm. You know, there is this low level of insurgency, and I think the analogy to the Irish Troubles is a terrific one, because these are, you know, improvised explosive devices. Military families are having to live in, you know, their own compounds to protect themselves. This is a level of challenge, I think, that the Myanmar military has never faced before, and it's going to be debilitating over time. The other thing I would say is, you know, there would be one capital that would be delighted to hear of all of this isolation and economic disinvestment in Myanmar, and that would be in Beijing. You know, this is an absolute geopolitical boon for China, because what it had seen after, you know, the return of democratic government was, you know, this slow kind of movement away from Beijing's clutches, and people used to speculate and wonder how much there was a fear of getting too close to China behind, you know, the military giving up power last time around. All of this kind of, you know, economic turmoil and isolation is playing into Beijing's hands, because it makes the Myanmar military much more dependent on Chinese assistance.
Mm. Interesting. Look, at that whole question of whether populist or, you know, dictatorships can rule well is pertinent to our last topic today, the Philippines, where listeners may not quite realise this. Rodrigo Duterte, the very much the authoritarian leader who sort of just seemed to be rampant in the way he pursued alleged drug runners and so on, he's set to be gone after a May election this year. His six-year term is finished by law, and the possibility that he may run on a ticket with his daughter is now gone. Now, is anyone regretting Duterte's departure? I read that the respected Filipino commentator Richard Hadarian said that his approval has plummeted. So, and it's about competence and the way he managed the pandemic. It's not about the drug dealers. So there's been a shift in sentiment by the sound of it, Emma.
I think so. I think it's been a pretty long 6 years of this presidency, and some of the shine definitely came off. The pandemic has been quite badly handled. The vaccination rates are still quite low. And I guess, you know, the big fear at the minute is that there will be an outbreak around the time of the May 9th election, because there isn't any postal voting in the Philippines. People do have to go to the booths to tick the box. So, you know, we just hope that they can all get out there, because they are very keen voters, the Philippines. I mean, the democracy is very lively, and it's not, you know, it's sort of overshadowed by these political dynasties, which seems strange to us, but they're all very engaged.
Yeah, but 3 in 10 voters are between 18 and the mid-20s. And a lot of them are going to be voting for the first time.
And I was talking to someone who had to go and register, so you have to, again, physically walk down and register, and he said there were queues around the block. These young people waited for hours to get their names on the rolls so they can vote.
Yeah, I mean, they're quite an affair, the presidential elections. And this year, it is an unusual ticket. Ferdinand Marcos Jr. better known as Bong Bong, is running with Duterte's daughter, Sarah, as vice presidential candidate. I mean, these dynasties, truly, how do they survive?
Yeah, no, it's like a telenovela. But it's, you know, it's politics is dominated by a powerful elite. It's dynastic politics more than it is party-based politics. In fact, parties or political parties are quite weak in the Philippines. And what strikes me of Duterte at the end of the day is much of a worrying and alarming game changer as he has been is also just the key continuities that we see in both the way he came to power, the way he leaves power, the fact that his daughter has turned against him and is now running with Ferdinand Marcos's 64-year-old son, who was a former ally and is now an enemy, and you just see how this dynastic politics is constantly recalibrating its configurations, but continues to be basically very much at the center of it all. And this is, you know, a democracy run through patronage and clientelism and corruption, essentially. And not much of that has changed fundamentally. And that's why I'm not actually that optimistic about the post-Duterte era. We may well get a more normal president, but ultimately the system that produced Duterte is still very much intact.
And it's true, isn't it, that Duterte and his family tend to sort of control the south, although Mindanao has turned against him from what I read, and the Marcoses tend to control the north.
Yes, exactly, which is why that ticket is so compelling to have Sara Duterte and Marcos Jr. Running together, and that you know that does sound quite compelling. Look, you can never really predict the course of
even though
Philippine
Marcos
elections.
Jr. is hardly charismatic, from what one reads.
Yeah, that's right. But we wouldn't have characterized Duterte as charismatic. I think there is a race for ownership of. You know, Duterte maybe has been, but he remains actually oddly very popular with the poor classes. And I think there is a race for who can assume the mantle and inherit that legacy. So they're still I think, a degree of envy for Duterte's popularity among poorer Filipino voters, and that's why Sara Duterte is in there in the mix and hoping to capitalize on that. She doesn't get along with her father. She blames her father for her parents' divorce. But the name still, I mean, it's that odd continuity. The name still carries some political currency in the Philippines.
Yes, we'll see how much.
Geraldine, could I just have a quick burst on the Philippines? Yeah. I actually think that Duterte's most interesting legacy will be in foreign policy. I think he has, more than any other Philippines president, positioned the Philippines in a really interesting place. He's retained the relationship with the United States and all of the benefits of that military alliance with the United States, but he has consciously balanced that with building a relationship with China and with Russia. And I think he's done that in a much more explicit way, going back to what Hervé was saying about the way that Southeast Asians are being much more nuanced in how they're positioning amidst this rivalry. And what will be really interesting will be how the next set of Philippines presidents interpret that legacy, whether they go back to a much closer cleaving to the United States or whether they continue that explicit balancing.
Gee, well, that's a narrative of their own too, isn't it, to go back to our earlier conversation?
Absolutely.
Look, thank you very much. That's just a taste of what's happening around us. So, look, my thanks to you all for kicking us off this year. Hervé Lamahieu from the Lowy Institute, thank you to you.
Thank you, Geraldine. It's great to be back.
Emma Connors from the Financial Review, based in Southeast Asia, thank you to you.
Thanks very much.
And Professor Michael Wesley, her Deputy Vice-Chancellor International at the University of Melbourne. Thanks to you, Michael.
A pleasure, Geraldine. Thanks.